council. Come on up to your places at the tables. I'll call the case. This is A24-1814 Capital Construction LLC. Allens. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. And at the start of which, please state your name and a party or parties you represent. The podium goes up and down. Council for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. This argument is being live streamed, but an audio version only will appear later on our public website. And with that, Council for Appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jason Zurich. I'm the attorney for the appellate's defendants below, the Hanslicks. We're requesting an order reversing the trial court and remanding it back for entry of judgment in favor of the Hanslicks. We believe that the trial court erred in determining that Capital proved actual damages in this case, because no documentary evidence was provided or presented to substantiate those damages. Under Minnesota law, the plaintiff has the burden of proving compensatory or actual damages. That's an amount to compensate for a proven injury or loss, or to repay for an actual loss. And that has to be to a reasonable certainty, and the amount of those damages to a reasonable probability. Party cannot recover damages that are speculative, remote, or conjectural. They must have been contemplated by the parties at the time the contract was made, or so likely to result from the breach that they can reasonably be said to have been foreseen. The damages may not be based on general administrative expenses without proof that they were increased by the defendant's breach. And a party recovering damages for a breach of contract should not be better off because of the breach than he would have been had there not been a breach.
Why shouldn't we consider Exhibit 1 to be... Well, accepting your argument that there has to be documentary evidence rather than just the testimony that was received by the district court, why shouldn't we consider Exhibit 1 to be evidence that supports the district court's damages award?
The purported contract in this case that contains the provision for profits isn't documentary evidence supporting that amount. It's a liquidated damages clause.
Well, the 10% overhead and 10% profit was viewed as separate from the liquidated. The district court didn't award damages under the liquidated damages clause, but basically used the 10% plus 10% formula and used that, right? So why isn't that a valid evidence supporting the damages award?
Because that's just another liquidated damages clause.
Why isn't it expected,
expectation payment?
Yeah, expectation damages.
Because there was no actual loss. If I have you sign a contract to provide you insurance proceeds for me to complete work, never complete the work, and then use that money to get your house fixed, I can't just come after you and sue you for that profit.
But didn't Capital Construction invest time and energy in negotiating with the insurance company to improve the amount that the insurance company was going to award the Hanslicks and ultimately did?
But that wasn't substantiated at the trial court.
What does that mean? There was testimony about that.
There was testimony.
And why? That's evidence.
Yes, but it wasn't specified as to what dates, the amount of time, or what efforts were even put forth. The number of emails that may have been sent, the hours and what days that were spent, the days that were time that was spent, none of that was used at the trial court below.
So as I see your argument, they could have There could have been an award for the time and amount spent in actually performing work under the contract, but there wasn't sufficient evidence to say how much that was valued at. And even though they did work under the contract, expectation damages can't be awarded. That the only thing that could be awarded was for their time. They could not get expectation damages, even though they testified that they did work under the contract. That's the part that I'm like having some trouble. You're saying you, I think you're limiting the type of damages that would be available when one party does in fact testify to the work that they did under the contract. You're saying you could, they could only get reimbursed for that amount of time spent versus their expectation damages under the contract.
They were awarded money for both the roof and windows in the contract. The roof was completed, the work was done. The window portion, there was never any work completed on that. So had Capital done work on the window portion, then yes, they would have been entitled to actual damages. But if I never performed...
the work that was done in the testimony that they were negotiating with, or, you know, dealing with the insurance company, et cetera, the testimony that was provided, that the district court, I think, didn't, you know, award testimony based on those like hours, right? Instead awarded the expectation damages. But I'm wondering what makes that wrong precisely.
That awarding compensatory damages on testimony that's just many, many hours is not specific enough. It's not definite enough to meet that reasonable certainty standard.
Is there a legal error in your view in the district court's essentially the, and I understand our remand instructions last time you were here said if the district court decides not to award liquidated damages on remand, then the district court is to evaluate actual damages. I'm paraphrasing. Is there a legal distinction that is noteworthy or amounts to error in the district court's decision to award expectation damages versus actual damages in the way that you seem to be arguing, where actual damages would have been timesheets, I spent this number of hours going out to the site and then negotiating with the insurance company. Expectation damages is essentially based on Exhibit 1 and what the anticipated or what the stated contract price was going to be.
But at the time that contract was made, that amount, neither party had any idea what that was. It was completely uncertain.
Right. Well, I mean, but the parties agreed to contract. That was the contract that the parties agreed to, right? I mean,
right.
They agreed to that language.
But I would say that is in the trial court, by essentially enforcing another provision in the contract, even though it's not titled liquidated damages clause, it's a liquidated damages clause. They just picked a different liquidated damages clause to enforce.
I didn't really notice you advancing this argument in your brief. I know that you have a portion of your brief that argues that this is a penalty in this appeal, that this provision is a liquidated damages clause. You don't really support why it's a penalty. I mean, I do see this as a little different than the other provision that was before us the last time, and that this is specifically related to the amount that the insurance company ultimately awards. It includes a measure of overhead and then a percent of profits that the construction company was anticipating or expecting that it would reap at the end of the project. So I do see this as distinct from the liquidated damages clause. Can you explain why you disagree with that?
And so if it were to award the 10% profit and overhead for the work performed on the windows project, that is zero.
But they weren't allowed to do the work because your client breached the contract, which is not a contested issue, right?
After about two years and 2 months, they decided that they wanted to get their windows replaced.
So, I mean, the fact of the breach isn't contested, so we can't use work done because Capital Construction wasn't allowed to complete the work, right?
They had over 2 years to complete the work.
Okay. But you're not contesting that there was a breach by your client in this appeal. The focus of the appeal is on the damage of the ward, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why isn't, I guess, you want to elaborate on your penalty/liquidated damages argument as to why we should conclude that this is a penalty or liquidated damages rather than a measure of expectation damages?
Because it places Capital in a better place than had it completed the work. And for the work it's actually completed on the window portion.
And what in the record should we conclude shows that it places them in a better position rather than this measure or estimate that the parties agreed to was going to be what Capital Construction would expect it would receive at the end of the project?
Because that amount was uncertain at the beginning. It was speculative. Looking at, had Capital done the work or any work for the windows and substantiated that in the trial court, they would be entitled to those damages. But just having a contract that states expectation damages of 10% profit and 10% overhead, that's just a liquidated damages clause in disguise. You can't support that within of itself. You would have to substantiate what 10% profit usually looks like and what their overhead usually looks like.
Well, I mean, we do have testimony in the record that the estimated amount of effort just in securing the insurance, the increased insurance award, was $5,000, right? And this ended up being a little more than $6,000 using the measure that the district court used. So it's, I don't know that there's a basis. Well, why should we conclude that this is so far off of what Capital Construction would have put Capital Construction in the same position based on that record that we should overturn the damages award?
Capital would have needed to put forth evidence that they typically receive 10% profit and 10% overhead and what those amounts are. Overhead on a $100,000 project versus $10,000 is very different. And if neither party knows that at the beginning, that's speculative.
So the contractual term you're saying is not, it's just too ambiguous to be or indefinite to be performed?
Correct.
Because they didn't yet know what the award was going to be.
Correct.
Okay. You have a couple minutes left if you want to continue.
So a contractor's damages resulting from a breach of a construction agreement can be ascertained or measured by ordinary rules and or susceptible of definite measurement. So I believe that the trial court erred for several reasons. First, I think the court incorrectly found that the exhibits admission were objected without admission or without objection. The Hanslicks objected to both the exhibits for untimely disclosure per the trial court's pretrial scheduling order. However, that objection was overruled.
Why was that prejudicial error when you haven't challenged the content of it, the accuracy of the contract itself? I mean, we've been discussing the contractual language throughout your argument, and it doesn't seem like there's any dispute. I mean, there was attached to the complaint that's what the contract said. So even assuming we agree with you that there was evidentiary error by the district court, or the finding of fact is clearly erroneous in saying there was no objection, why Why is that prejudicial error?
Well, it's untimely disclosure of what the exhibits at trial are going to be.
But you were aware of the exhibit at trial. I mean, you were aware of it.
Aware of.
So then how was your client prejudiced given it, you know, by the admission of the document, given that it was aware, you were aware of the document at the time of trial?
Being aware of a document is one thing. Knowing that it's going to be used in an exhibit is separate. There's more time that's put into looking at an exhibit that's going to be, or a document that's going to be used as an exhibit, to focus on, okay, how is it going to be authenticated? What is the foundation that needs to be laid?
But you didn't make those objections at trial about authentication or foundation. Correct?
No, correct.
Okay. Counsel, you will have, I think your red light is on. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal, and we look forward to hearing from you then. And counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mary Hahn. I am here for the respondent, Capital Construction. What we are asking is that this court affirm the district court's decision in all respects, but for a remand to allow us to ask for additional attorney's fees incurred in this appeal. There is an attorney's fees provision in the contract. This case has had a winding journey. And it started in the conciliation court over 5 years ago, and here we are. If the court would bear with me to let me do a little bit of recap on procedural history, it will help, I think, inform why the district court's current order makes sense and is arguably quite conservative, if I may say, in its ultimate award of damages. Your honors are aware, this is the second time we are at the Court of Appeals on a contract that is 2 pages. It is not a long contract, and it is a standard in the industry contract. As your honors are aware, Capital does repair work, often due to storm damage, and its business model, like all of these companies, not, I shouldn't say all, like many of these companies, is simple. We will do the work for you for what your insurance company approves. And that is the model of this industry. And it helps speed the process. It helps homeowners who may not know the navigation with the insurance company. And Capital here, the initial approval for windows was $1,600. And after 8 months, Capital got an award of over $30,000 for the Hanslick for window replacement. And as your honors have noted from the record, there is copious amounts of testimony from Eric Bergeson, one of the officers of Capital, about what he did on this file to achieve that award. And it was actually an estimate of $15,000, your honor, not $5,000, but $15,000 in estimated personnel time, not including overhead. So as we know, the amount cannot be known at the time the parties sign the contract because it remains to be determined by the insurance company. Now, here's, I think, an important point. Capital is taking a risk each time it enters into a contract like this because Capital is bound to perform the work, for contractually bound, for whatever the insurance company approves. So the business model, it understands it is taking that risk. Here, the court noted this, the district court noted this, the homeowner specifically authorized Capital to engage with its insurance company to facilitate a greater award, which in fact happened after about, again, 8 to 9 months of work. There is no dispute that the homeowners breached this contract. I would use the term repudiation. And there was no evidence whatsoever offered by the homeowners in this case at trial. They did not testify. They did not offer documents. Notably, there were no post-trial motions filed. None. And I did touch on the scope of review, the impact of that in my brief at page 12. In order number one, which I did include in my addendum just for convenience, as we know, the district court upheld the liquidated damages provision. And around this time, the Lagoon case came out. That's a 2023 case. And the homeowners appealed, as and just yesterday I listened again to oral argument, which was a year ago, last April, and my esteemed associate, Catherine Wagner, was here for Capitol. And I found it, this is a side note, interesting, because one of the judges on the panel said, I don't necessarily find harmony in the cases about liquidated damages clause, and we've lost some common sense. And I think that's a kind of a good liquidated damages clause cases. They can be they're a bit confusing and they can be all over the place. But in any event, what the Court of Appeals decided last year was the district court had applied the wrong burden that had shifted the burden of proof to homeowners, so it was remanded, differentiating prima facie from burden of proof. And the new Lagoon case at the time was cited. So on remand, this court's instructions.
Can I stop you?
Yeah.
So I appreciate your review of the procedural history, but at this point, I just wanted to ask.
Mm-hmm.
The end of our opinion, the last time you were here, says, and I asked this to your colleague on the other side, if the district court determines that the liquidated damages clause is unenforceable, the district court shall decide Capital's claim for actual damages. And it seems to me that the nub of the Hanslick's argument on appeal is that the district court didn't award actual damages. I understand you've drawn the distinction between the testimony that Mr. Bergeson made before the district court or offered before the district court, that 150 man hours estimate at $100 an hour is 15. He did say that he thought the profit would be $5,000. But the district court expressly did not rely on that. Although the district credited Mr. Bergeson, the district court ultimately went on to say that they just thought that was an estimate, so the district court looked to the contract,
yep,
which you argue in your brief essentially is an award of expectation damages. And so what I'm wondering is, did the district court follow our remand instructions? I mean, these aren't what we would classically consider a measure of actual damages. This is a measure of expectation damages based on the language of the contract. And so is that an abuse of discretion?
No, respectfully. Actual damages, I consider that as a broader term. What are the actual damages? We have the liquidated damages provision that was set aside. Then we pled in the alternative all damages flowing from breach of the contract. So there was two causes of action in our complaint. And we knew to do that because we were hearing the pushback on the liquidated damages provision. So the district court did not err. I don't agree that lost profit and overhead is not under the category of actual damages. It flows from the breach. It flows from the breach.
Right, well, I guess what I mean is it's not, and again, I understand this to be their point, this isn't substantiated with timesheets beyond, and that's what the district court came to that conclusion. This was an estimate that Mr. Bergeson testified to, rather than, we spent 33 hours on this negotiation. I went out to the site this number of times. Here's my mileage for going out. Here are the costs associated with me consulting any sort of text I might have need to consult in order to come up with this better estimate or better award from the insurance company. Instead, it was just insurance award times 20%, right? I mean, that's what was done. So is there legal error in awarding? I mean, and that, again, I can see how that's expectation damages because the parties agreed to that in the contract. But is that actual damages, or maybe the better question is, does it matter?
No. Okay, starting with the easy. No, I think the directive for remand, we have to give some leeway and discretion to the district court. Okay. So in my humble opinion, respectfully, I wish the district court had given us the full $15,000 because I think that was sufficiently testified about. But putting that aside, that's not on appeal. What the court did is I'm going to be conservative and I'm going to look at just that initial paragraph at the top of that defines total cost, and at minimum going to give Capital their overhead and profit as what the court said the unambiguous contract terms provide for. That's it. And Your Honor's question goes to my point about 30,000 foot view, the entire model of this industry. It, under the homeowner's position in this case, Capital could essentially never recover if a homeowner did not permit them to do that, if the homeowner canceled the contract before Capital could do the work. They are not a law firm where we bill in 0.6 increments, obviously. That's not their industry. That is why liquidated damages provisions are so common in the industry. For reasons that we don't have to go through, it wasn't upheld here. And so the court looked to a different method of damages, which is wholly supported by the contract terms. And I think, Your Honor, if you... It seems as if the remand instructions are being applied a bit too narrowly. The district court could have, I would say, have reopened the record and invited us to return, but it chose not to. It used the record that it had and then reissued order two. So no error whatsoever. And it's so difficult for me to wrap my head around the homeowner's argument that, well, you know, we didn't know it at the time of the contract. Of course we didn't know it at the time of the contract. That's the business model. We're waiting to see what the appraisal award could have been much less, and Capital would have been bound to do the same work.
Well, it seems to me that maybe the reason for the language we chose in our last opinion was related to the way that the case law discusses analyzing liquidated damages clause by first looking to whether actual damages are incapable or very difficult of accurate estimation, rather than necessarily, and that's why the term actual damages was used in the remand instructions, rather than there's some legal command. My concern is that that's what we said, and your brief seems to just argue expectation damages. The district court's order seems to say, understand that it was supposed to look at actual damages, but essentially is ordering expectation damages. And I don't know, it might just be a distinction without a difference. And the reason for our language in the last opinion was just because that's how the case law talks about liquidated damages. Is that your take?
I'm not certain I am. Well, this gets back to the challenge of liquidated damages case law. It almost makes it seem like liquidated damages are nigh impossible to prove in a business industry like Capital, absent incredible bookkeeping that is just not reasonable on the ground. So I think here what's important is the court incorporated its findings of fact 1 through 20. I think that's important in its second order. Because there was testimony about anticipated overhead on a job like this from Mr. Bergeson. There was testimony about the hours spent. And in this case, the court, I think, was, again, conservative and awarded the bare minimum of what the contract term said.
Can I ask, counsel?
Yeah.
Because I just want to understand your position. As I heard you say, like, back a few questions, in your view, expectations may be a form of actual damages. Is that correct? Or do you think that expectation, I mean, obviously it's something that we can do the research on and figure out. I just want to know your answer on whether expectation damages are, in fact, not a form of actual damages.
Well, the cases I cited in Logan, expectation damages attempt to provide the non-breaching party in the position it would have been in. Mm-hmm. And I don't recall ever reading a case that said expectation is the same as actual. But when you think
of
the bucket of how can I be put back in the same position? Mm-hmm. That would include my lost profit and overhead, along with the personnel hours. That's, I think, what I meant. I hope that clarifies.
Okay.
Again, this has been an interesting winding case, and I find it, you know, the whole liquidated damages provision piece, which is now behind us, it brings into focus that the district court acknowledged and made note of all the time and effort Capital had put in. And I think that's a factor that the court wanted to be sure was noted because it included it in its findings of fact. What I note is that, 43 seconds. Appellants focus on what evidence was or what was not provided by Mr. Bergeson, wherein the district court relied on what it called the unambiguous terms of the contract. So arguably the testimony of Mr. Bergeson would be moot because the court relied on, again, the terms of the contract. Yet the court included findings, again, in order number 2, about all the time and effort, which I think goes to the issue of reasonableness of the 10% overhead and profit. I see my time is up, if I may just finish my sentence. The out-of-pockets that Mr. Bergeson actually testified to exceeded $15,000. I understand the district court said that was a little bit squishy, but it was still included in the findings. And when you look at that figure compared to the award of just over $6,000, to say this is unreasonable, I think would be a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Wanted to just touch on liquidated damages clauses. Those are agreed to contractual damages, and they have been found to be enforceable in a lumber contract for goodwill, because goodwill is tough to measure. You can't measure that. It's indefinite. That is a term the court has found that that's something that could be a liquidated damage clause. We find this in stadium contracts. If a stadium isn't done on time and there's going to be a game, a show, concert, the amount of damages that that owner of the venue is going to suffer because of that delay is indeterminate at the start because they don't know how long the delay is going to be or what may cause the delay. Another great example is road construction, public works projects. The harm to the public because of a delay in a public works project is hard to determine. If we're down from 3 lanes to 2 lanes for an extra month, that is difficult to determine. So in those contracts, they have agreed to damages, a liquidated damages clause that specifies how much, whether it's over in days or in time, that would be enforced if it goes beyond that date. Those are examples of when a liquidated damages clause is appropriate because you can't determine it. Here, Capital, just because they didn't keep time cards, document, support, show the efforts that they put forth so it could be reasonably ascertained to what it was, they would be entitled to what those damages were, the actual damages. But expectation damages aren't what they actually were harmed. So I think by enforcing the profit and overhead provision in this case, it's a penalty because as long as this contract held out there, Capital would have been able to hold it over the Hanslicks to say, well, if you cancel now, here's this liquidated damage clause provision, 25%. It's ours. And now it's 10% profit and 10% overhead.
I think the reasoning, just so for the argument, is that it's one thing to get back what you spent in your time, but I think the argument for being awarded as your what you lost, profit and overhead, is that, well, the overhead isn't compensated, and the profit, if you don't get it, you would have spent your time doing something else. I think that would be the argument for why it's actually compensating them. Like, it's one thing to get paid their hourly rate, but they're not going to get the profit that they anticipated on getting by performing that work. You know, I think that's why it looks like potentially that they that the lost overhead and the lost profit is actually putting them back in a position that they'd be in but for the breach. They wouldn't have spent time doing this work except with the idea of getting some profit, not just getting their employees paid. You know what I'm saying?
But they would need to support that with documentation that they actually did spend that time. When did they spend that time? What day? How long? What did they do? It's not uncommon in the construction industry to document what laborers do on a daily basis. It's not uncommon for anyone to just document the amount of time they spend on something. Wouldn't be a good business model if you didn't do that. But in some, I believe that the trial court incorrectly found that Capital proved actual damages. I don't believe that they proved the existence of lost profits to a reasonable certainty, and I don't believe they proved the amount of such damages to a reasonable probability. As such, I believe that the trial court incorrectly entered judgment for Capital, and we ask for remand, reversal, and judgment in favor of the Hanslicks. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go out of order a little bit. Can you take the podium again? I forgot to ask a question.
Sure.
I'm sorry about this. The resolution you asked for is a remand for attorney's fees. The district court awarded attorney's fees up till the point of, what are you asking for the remand? Attorney's fees for what? The appeal?
This appeal.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the award for attorney's fees was in the $12,000 range. That was not raised as an issue on appeal by the appellants. So that is not, so we're just asking for a remand for additional fees.
Thank you.
Over and above.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, thank you both. Thank you both very much for your briefing, your argument. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period, and we appreciate your appearance here today. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm okay.
Break. Oh, sure. Oh, whatever.